7. Welcome, members. We have a number of bills on the docket for this afternoon, but I'm confident that we can move through them. I am going to go ahead and open a public hearing on House Bill 2588. And Mr. Olson, when you have a chance, if you could fill us in, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2588, the original bill, creates a task force on high school graduation, directs the task force to study obstacles to high school graduation. That was the original bill. There are two amendments before you, both of which would change the focus of the bill and replace the entire text. The dash one amendment, thank you, would direct that a school cannot have more than 10% of the average daily membership of the school absent during a month, not including students on individualized education programs, or IEPs. Direct the superintendent of public instruction to notify a school not meeting the standard, as well as the school district. Direct the superintendent of public instruction find the school deficient under Oregon Revised Statute 327.103, a copy of which is, I believe, with you along with the amendments, which sets forth an established procedure for dealing with schools found deficient, including oversight and assistance from the Department of Education and potential withholding of portions of the state school fund monies. That's the dash one amendment. The dash two amendment is entirely the same, except for it applies to school districts, except for schools. So dash one, individual schools. Dash two is the school district as a whole. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. And to note, if anyone is focusing on the agenda, we did pass House Bill 2217 to revenue last Friday. So that is just so you know that you don't have to stick around if that's what you're here for. It's already gone. Good luck to it. Representative Kopp, would you please come forward and tell us why this bill is necessary?
Thank you. My name for the record is Betty Kopp, and I represent House District 22. And before I begin today, I really want to thank Chair Buckley and Staff Olson that I've been working on attendance issues, I feel like it, for about 15 years, but been working collaboratively with some of our colleagues in the Revenue Committee, and then also met with some person from the OEA to get some suggestions on this bill. Earlier in the session, I had written a bill about attendance, and there was a direct linkage to funding for average daily attendance instead of average daily membership. The committee, Revenue Committee, was very thorough in listening, and I listened to their thoughts and appreciated their work because they challenged me to go steps farther. And as we find in most all legislation, if it's looked at from multiple perspectives, you get a better idea and a better bill. With that, I had several suggestions just recently how we might look at student attendance. Just that you know, my passion about student attendance is that I empirically believe that if a student's there, his opportunity to learn and be more successful is greater. And with that belief, once students in middle school and high school, they have a propensity to stop off at the local corner store, not get to school when they should be, go shopping somewhere else. And then when they get into high school, if they have any sort of addiction problems or parents that are, I'll speak for as a single mom, if it wasn't, I kept my children in a small high school, and I knew all the teachers and the administrators, so if my daughter skipped school, I knew real quickly. But in our current system, that just isn't the way it can work all the time. And so, colleagues, I bring to you an option to looking at student attendance, and just as you to focus this. This is not to penalize the system. This is to have schools or a district to take and look at how many students are attending and how many aren't. I asked for a report from the Department of Education as background information, and I found in the report it is a minor amount, less than 2% of schools, school districts, that drop below just to get to an 89 or an 88% attendance. But also as a piece of background, currently, the way our funding formula works, it has nothing in all essence to do with attendance. It is, and I know I have people here that can correct me if I'm wrong, it's all about enrollment. If a student is enrolled and can and a district can show that the student is enrolled, then a district gets full ADMW revenue. It has not, there's no awareness of how many days, well, they can pull it up how many days a student was in attendance, but there's no focus on it. There's no shine of light saying student X has been gone 6 days. That light comes on that student after 10 days, but with the current statute, a student can attend 15 to 20 days for the entire school year, and not saying that he wouldn't get some attention, because I think after that period of absence, he certain if the student would draw attention. But the reality is these students, after they get to the secondary level, really start into a downward spiral because they've missed so many days and they can't catch up. And the person that pays for their consequence is the teacher. Teachers have to reteach. Pretty soon they're so busy reteaching their curriculum because students have been absent so much, they can't even get to new curriculum. And so with that, I'm just going to share what the bill does and then open it up for any questions you have, because we do have other things on the agenda. And my request for this committee is to, if you are so inclined, to allow me to take this to the Revenue Committee to fully vet it. But if you think this comp you're crazy, don't hesitate to let me know that, too. And what this bill would do...
These aren't mutually exclusive, right?
I've been called worse. But this bill would have Department of Education monitor have schools already turn in their attendance monthly. But then the department would notify the district if they drop below that 90% mark. And then they would follow the statutes that are already in place for compulsory attendance to work with the district to help them give suggestions if student attendance isn't above that. And there's like a full plan of assistance that takes 3 to 5 years. But the purpose only for me is not to penalize districts, but to put, like I say, put a little bit of a spotlight on attendance and make sure that students are attending. And the difference between the dash ones and the dash twos, as Staff Olson has said, is one is for like the whole district and the other one is per school. With that, committee, any questions or suggestions?
Thank you, Representative. Representative Dolan.
Yes, Representative Comp, when you went from schools to districts, what percentage of the schools, when you cast your net, would you catch? How many are in the 10% range when you do school?
When you do the schools, and in particular, you'd be looking at the middle school, particularly high schools, it still would be, I don't have the exact figure, Representative Dolan, I'd have to go calculate it, but it still wasn't a strong amount. Is probably less than 15% of the schools, because most of the schools, including the secondary schools, their attendance is 93, 94, 95%.
Further questions? Where's the Rilden?
I'm a person who believes that we should put incentives in place for schools to do this kind of stuff, as opposed to this other side. And because when I look at it, I knew exactly what I would do as a school district if I didn't want to hit the 20%, and that is withdraw the kids for non-attendance for a particular period of time and then re-enroll them the next week. I mean, I would make sure I never went below 90%, so I'm not getting at anything other than we would save a few dollars because they would have a few people less for any particular month to keep it at the 90%. I mean, the concern that I have is that what we're really talking about in these kinds of fields, if you really look at the statistics around the country on where schools have the least attendance, you find the places where people are the poorest are the place where you have the worst attendance. And part of that has to do with the fact that they don't have health insurance, they don't have other things, so we're not getting at the root causes of why kids miss school. We're working at trying to get the schools to force things upon people and force them to come back to school. That concerns me with respect to this bill. We've already had this kind of discussion a couple times before, so it's nothing new, but I would love to see a bill that gets at how do we help all kids come to school on a regular basis, because that's the most important thing.
Right.
But this kind of thing sometimes, from my perspective, forces school districts to do things, take extra time, and spend money getting around it so they will never get to 90%, because they don't like to have the superintendent say that they're deficient. So I am concerned that this will not do what it should be doing. So I would have to vote against them, and I've mentioned that before.
Thank you very much. Would you like to respond at all, Senator?
Well, as Representative Roblin shares, Chair Buckley, is the fact that we've had this conversation, and I wish there was incentives. I wish with all my heart that we were giving the state of Florida, literally if their students keep a certain GPA, they are giving their children full scholarships to their high school, well, their students to go to one of their state universities. Nothing would make me happier than to have that type of incentive so our students understand. You need a, you know, 2.5, and this is because actually Florida has a graduated scale. If they have a certain GPA, this is how much money they get.
Wow.
And, but right now, there is not in the system even any focus on attendance versus just student enrollment. So, and I'm willing, if this committee so says, let's look at this further, we'll look at it next session, I'm okay with that, too.
Thank you, Representative Dahlem, and then
I want to address some of Representative Roblin's concerns. I think probably my past history incentives are one of the strong suits I've had, but I want to start with where Representative Comp started with this problem, and I don't think that the intention is punitive. I think the intention is when you start approaching 10% absenteeism, there is now at least a trigger in the law that makes you look. Perhaps dropping a student is the answer, but I think there are some things that a district might attend to. Right now, there's absolutely nothing. There's no incentive, positive or negative, for a district to even address the issue, particularly when you get 10 days. And for that reason, I would support the dash ones.
Thank you, sir. Isn't it real briefly?
Yeah, real briefly. I was the dean of students for a long time, which does the attendance at our school, and I looked at all the different programs that were out there that would improve attendance, because that was the single most important thing in my life. I wanted attendance improved. And what I came to the conclusion was the only thing that showed any significant improvement in attendance was changing the attendance program every year. Because then they don't know what it is, and they don't, at least at the high school level. So they have to go there for a while before they figure it out. So we changed it every year. I mean, I'll do whatever I take. Number two, we had another district that decided they were going to go into, we're going to make it, if you miss 10 days in this class, because it is really hard for teachers, and I accept that.
It is really hard.
They decided we're going to go to school, and if you are gone 10 days, you lose the credit, and we put you in a study hall. And we also had a heavy truancy officer that went out and did stuff, and we have a person still in our districts that do that kind of stuff. And that truancy officer took those parents to court, and this one case, the kid was in six periods of study hall because he'd missed all those, and the judge said, what are you bringing him in for truancy? I wouldn't go to school if I was in six periods of study hall either. What's the point? And so the truancy officer, who was bringing it against the parent, like you're supposed to with regard to the laws that we currently have, basically said, school district, if you have a rule that says after 10 days they're down, why are you trying to also come here and get the money for the kid who's enrolled? Because there's no reason for a person to be enrolled. I have never seen any program that sets up standards that are punitive to actually work. Now, if you want to go about this, there's other ways to do it. But this, from my perspective, and that's all I'll say, because it was shocking when I figured out that the only correlation of positive attendance was to change the system. Even if you made it more lenient, you had better attendance. It was the fact that you changed it.
I'd be willing to change this next session.
Thank you, Representative Comp.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else? No one else has signed up. Is there anyone else here who wanted to weigh in on this bill? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing for House Bill 2588. I will open a work session on House Bill 2588. I'd entertain a motion to send this to revenue with no recommendation.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2588.
Representative Dahlmus moved the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2588.
With a subsequent referral to revenue?
Well, we got to do the Dash 1s first. Okay. So any discussion on Dash 1s? Hearing none. Any objections?
Can I ask a question?
Yes, you can, Representative.
What's the consequences of doing it by school rather than by school district?
The difference is it is an absolute rarity for a district to fall beneath the 90% line.
But let's say school X falls below the line. What are the consequences of that?
The consequences for that school is the superintendent of instruction, the Department of Education, according to my understanding, is that they would notify the superintendent of the school, and the superintendent would let the principal know, say, hey, I see your attendance has dropped. There is no consequence other than a notification. That's the way council explained the statute.
Is that relevant?
My understanding of the statute is that it would make you non-compliant, and eventually, if you didn't get compliant, you'd have a chance to do a plan. Eventually, the state could withhold their public school support for your school if you were continued to be non-compliant.
I would say that would get some attention.
Representative Clem.
Yeah, I think there is a reference to at some point you become, quote, deficient, and then there's a chapter of the law. Somebody gave us a copy of, or me at least, that talks about what happens when you're deficient. And they say if you're not corrected before the beginning of the year, and if extension has not been granted, the superintendent may withhold portions of the state school fund monies otherwise allocated to the school district for operating expenses until such deficiencies are corrected, unless the withholding would create an undue hardship.
Thank you, Representative.
Yeah.
Representative Cobb?
I had full discussion with that statute with council, and I can't speak for council because she's ill today, Cindy Hunt. But the way, if you read that full statute, it would take a minimum of 3 years before there would be any fiscal penalty, because there is, like, seriously, it's like a plan of assistance.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah,
if there's somebody here that knows different, I would certainly, Council Hunt and I talked at length about that. Because it's just a notification, and then if they fall below the standard for a whole year, then there would be a directive to make improvement.
I'm sorry to take up the time, but can I just follow up a little?
I mean, wouldn't it seem to me, Representative Roblin, if I were the principal and I were below 90%, I'd solve the problem. I'd kick out everybody who wasn't showing up for school, and then I'd get above 90%. Wouldn't help anything. Well, it might. Get rid of the trouble.
Well, these aren't there anyway. They're usually not there.
So you'd lose some money. I mean, that's what would happen. That would be the consequence. Right. You throw them out, and you lose some of the... Mm-hmm. Okay.
Representative Lim.
Yes, I see some problem that those schools, more than 10%, already have some problems. Instead of giving them more tools and more funding to correct the problem, chances are after two, 3 years, take the money away, it will make them even harder. So it's not going to help them at all.
Thank you, Representative. Representative, we do have a consensus split committee. As a courtesy to Vice Chair Kopp, I am willing to move this bill to revenue with no recommendation. If committee members can either vote yes or no on that as they desire.
You want a motion?
And we have a motion on the Dash 1 amendment. Is there any further discussion on the Dash 1? Any objection to the Dash 1 amendment? Hearing none. So amended. Representative Dahlem.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2588 to the House floor as amended, with a recommendation and a subsequent referral to the Revenue Committee.
Without recommendation. Representative Dahlem's moves House Bill 2588 as amended to the floor with no recommendation, with subsequent referral to the Committee on Revenue as per prior reference.
No.
I did say with no recommendation. Without prior reference. Without prior reference. Thank you very much for that clarification. is there any discussion? Representative Clem.
Here, I plan to support with a courtesy vote to get over there. Now, if you really want to solve this problem, what you will do is the dean of students of your high school will tell your mother, who is a teacher, the one time you skipped class in 4 years, and when you came back, she was waiting in my chair.
Can we amend the bill to have that put in?
If only every parent would be doing that.
Yeah. I just had to buy some supplies for the next class.
Actually, just thinking of having Representative Clem's mother be available throughout the state.
That would help too, yeah.
That's the way to go about this. Andy, would you please call the roll?
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative
Gollum? Aye.
Representative
Greenlight?
Aye.
Representative
Cromwell?
Aye.
Representative
Cromwell?
Aye. Representative
Griblin? Courtesy, no.
Aye.
Aye.
So moved. Good luck in that.
I do want to put on the record that I never skipped school even once. But there were most of my teachers wished I had.
Well, and my only comment to this committee is I assure you that the revenue committee, the test you gave me today is nothing compared to what they'll work me through. So
that's probably true.
And that's good for the bill.
I'll close the work session on House Bill 2588 and open the work session on House Bill 3344. Mr. Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3344 allocates from the Administrative Services Economic Development Fund to School Capital Matching Subaccount, amount by which monies in the fund available for allocation in each biennium exceeds the amount projected to be available for allocation. Declares an emergency, is effective on passage. If committee remembers from previous discussions, this deals with lottery money over and above that which is projected to be taken in. The Dash 1 amendment for you, it's the same one we discussed the last time. That basically is a technical amendment adding the Westside Lottery Bonds and the Lottery Bond Fund to the list of funds that are required to be paid before determining if they're excess funds. This bill does have a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Members, we did have a very good discussion on this in a previous hearing. It is somewhat concerning that the use of money, money being tight, but this is a viable source for the lottery funds to go to, the unexpected, the over-the-top lottery funds. Would you like to go ahead and make a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3344.
Representative Dahlem has moved the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3344. Is there discussion?
One question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cromwell.
So if we've made sure that the Westside lottery bonds for light rail are there, what about other bond measures that we have passed out relating to lottery bonds? Are they also the payoff of those also part of this? And as things get paid off, is that going to be considered excess revenue that then all of a sudden starts dumping into this fund?
Mr. Olson?
I think I answered the first part of Representative Crummell's question, Mr. Chair. Representative Crummell, in the bill itself, starts off the list that has to be paid first includes the Education Stability Fund and the School Capital Matching Subaccount, the Parks and Natural Resources Fund, and then adds in these on Westside Lottery Bonds and Lottery Bond Fund. This was at the suggestion of the Treasurer's Office, who was just checking it for technical accuracy. As to the second part of your question, whether or not this, as those get paid off, it's a good question. I suppose in the future that could have a larger amount that was excess, but also in the future there could be other bonds that would have to be added to be paid. But that wasn't specifically addressed, I think, because that was a hypothetical.
Mr. Chair, can I ask?
Representative Greenlee.
Is this money that could have gone into higher ed capital?
Into higher ed capital.
Yeah, into the higher ed capital fund instead of the K-12.
Yes, Mr. Olson, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that we could, basically this is a policy bill that we're putting forth our opinion that could go into any place that would be acceptable, Mr. Olson?
My understanding is yes. In the past, it's been used for other things, including schools. But this is to suggest a policy of where excess funds should go in the future. And there was some discussion in the past whether it should be a one-time versus an ongoing.
Further discussion? Representative Lim.
Is this a one-time deal, or is this continuously appropriate the money?
Representative, the dash ones do not change the time period involved with the funding. So my understanding of the bill, even with the dash ones, is that it would not be a one-time. It would be ongoing.
Okay. So
follow up.
So we have another bill, this excess money going to the capital construction, the community colleges, and plus other higher ed, and plus workforce economic development. So we need to choose what this one or that.
Representative Lim, I'm not sure the other bill that you're referring to.
Oh.
We did send on Friday the governor's proposal on funding to rules, but I'm not
operating funds.
That was
operating
funds.
But Ways and Means could decide how to move the money around.
Correct. Ways and Means could you know, again, we are saying a policy and saying to Ways and Means, but they could obviously set this where they would like it to go.
Okay, just clarification. Didn't we discuss to a past or still under discussion? I'm not sure. So many bills are going through. So we discussed of this excess amount going to the community colleges. And higher. No, is that a different matter?
That was a different matter. That was the corporate minimum tax.
Oh, yes, okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Dalby, do you have a comment?
It seems to me that if we were to start filling this can too fast, that the lottery would take a look at their budget process and tighten up their budget. So we're talking about money over planned or accounted for spending, so this could be a different amount every year.
Or no amount, right?
But the way the lottery runs their books, I don't think it'll be a different amount every year.
Thank you, Representative.
Representative Wilson, are you looking for a motion, Mr. Chair?
I think we have a motion on the
dash. I move House Bill 33.
We have a motion on dash one.
I'm in a hurry. I like
that. I appreciate
it. I move the dash one amendment, Mr. House Bill 3344.
Any further discussion on dash one? Hearing none. Any objection to dash one? So amended. Representative Don, do you have a motion?
I have a motion. I move House Bill 3344 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation and a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Don, this moves House Bill 3344 to the House floor with a due pass as amended recommendation with a subsequent referral to the Joint Ways and Means Committee by prior reference. Andy, any discussion?
Chair.
Representative Crum.
Continuing, or not continuing, but the same concerns that I expressed the other day I still have about this. So at this point I'm going to vote no, but also give myself the option of changing my mind and voting yes on the floor, depending on when it comes out of Ways and Means, and also additional information that I might glean from this along the way.
Very good. Thank you, Representative. Any other discussion? Representative Rubin.
I'll just make a real quick one. You know, we talked about higher ed could use this other. We have never had money in a fund. The fund that's there has never had any money. We have not helped local districts with respect to funding construction, real construction, maybe ever. We've done it for community colleges. We've done it for higher ed. This is a way to start saying, oh, after we've done all the expenditures we're exploring, we had extra money, we're going to give something to these communities that are rapidly growing and other communities that need to replace old buildings. And I think it's appropriate. So thanks.
Thank you, Representative Rubin.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Representative Greenland.
Yeah, to a certain extent, I agree with Representative Rubin, but I wouldn't like to see this frozen. I mean, it seems to me that Ways and Means ought to make the decision on an ongoing basis of where the needs are. And I just don't like the idea of siphoning this off and keeping it. I'm going to be a no one. I mean, I represent Beaverton and Hillsborough school districts that dramatically could use money. There's no question about that. And maybe Portland could. You know, they're selling everything. So. It's a different problem, but I just don't like the idea of freezing this in, not in perpetuity, because any other legislature can change it, but stating that as a matter of principle.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Dolan.
I said, when I look at the backlog of building necessary in K-12, this is a statement. There will not be enough money here for a long time. But it's a statement. That's all it is.
Thank you, Representative Dolan. Representative Lin.
I just want to express my concern, the future availability of the lottery money for bondings and plus many other programs by freezing this amount of money on top of it to the certain dedicated bond, and that we are tying the amount in the future. That's one of my concerns. This looks like a good deal. Is it possible we can put some kind of a sunset date on it instead of perpetuity of this issue? Or is it too late to do anything?
It's too late for us to do that, Representative, but I'm sure Ways and Means, again, can if they see fit.
I hope with my record, I hope they can do something about it.
Thank you, Representative. Any further discussion after Representative Greenlit's optimistic projection here on the
book? I'm a little pessimistic about Ways and Means at the moment.
Where are they? Where do they live?
Mr. Chair.
Who are these guys?
Could I remind the committee, or could I clarify for me? I think this was brought by Representative Hunt, correct?
Correct.
Okay, just wanted to clarify.
Thank you very much, Representative. Andy, would you please call the roll?
Who is that?
Cindy Hunt.
Yes. Representative Long?
Yes.
Representative Greenlit?
No.
Representative Cross?
Aye.
No.
Representative
Wynn?
Aye.
Representative
Aye. The motion carries. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3334. Open a work session on House Bill 2606. Mr. Olson. Representative Kremel, this is...
You want me to go down there, Mr.
Here, why don't you? Why don't you? And we'll throw things at you from here.
Okay.
That's on there.
I'll go down there so you can throw things at you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2606 modifies certain educational class requirements from years to credits, allows students to graduate in less than 4 years or advance to the next grade level if a student meets credit requirements for classes, applies to students who meet the requirements on or after the effective date of the Act, modifies requirement for children who must attend public schools by doing so, applies to the 2007-2008 school year, declares an emergency, is effective July 1st. You have before you a -4 amendment, which incorporates many of the previous amendments that have been discussed in this committee. It would clarify that local school district requirements, in addition to State Board of Education requirements, must be met prior to early graduation. It would clarify that early graduation or early grade advancement would only be at the request of the student and with parent or guardian consent, and would provide an exception for emancipated students or students 18 years of age or older. It was sent to the full committee without recommendation with the Education Innovation Committee. There was still being some work done on amendments at the time. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Representative Kremel, would you like to add anything?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, State Representative Jerry Kremel, House District 26, which is Wilsonville, Sherwood, Gaston, and Bull Mountain. As Mr. Olson has noted, there are the -3 and the -4 amendments. My own personal preference falls along the lines of the -3. However, I had after hearing some of the concerns that were raised at the Innovation Subcommittee, I had the -4 amendments drafted and am leaving it up to the committee as to whether or not you would prefer to adopt the -3 or the -4 amendments. I think the important thing here is that we're recognizing that we do have students that don't necessarily fit into the box, and that when a student can excel and accelerate their education and graduate early, we really ought to let them. One of the questions that came up in the Innovation Subcommittee was, it says, well, state law already allows it. Yes, state law does allow for a school district to be able to graduate a student early. However, one of the things that I found is that in talking, for example, to Courtney Miller, who testified before the Innovation Subcommittee, the school district made it a very difficult process for her to go through in order to be able to graduate early. And my feeling is, why should we be doing that to students? If we have students that are accelerating, why not let them go ahead and accelerate and be done? So what this would do is that while state law currently allows the school districts to graduate students early, this bill would require school districts to graduate students early if the student requests it and when they have met all of the state, and in the case of the Dash 4, the local district's requirements. So as I mentioned, the one thing that one of the things that was in the Dash 3 also is the requirement that a school district, once a student has started the ninth grade, that a school district can't start changing the requirements on those students until after they graduate. So any changes the district would make would have to have a delayed implementation date. That I understand rose some concerns of some of the members, and so there again I am open to the Dash 4s because we've taken that provision out, as well as then the allowance that the local district rules be met.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions for Representative Crummell? Representative Kahn.
Thank you, Chair Buckley. Representative Crummell, and this goes to a different issue, and if you haven't researched it, but I was just curious if in your readings or your thoughtfulness about this, I know some states allow SAT score if it gets to a certain point that they allow graduation, and I'm not saying that we ought to consider that this session, but again, it's to put the focus on academics and what your abilities, and they also have some proficiencies that go along with that rather than just school credits, but that's for another day unless you had some information.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kump, I don't. Other than anecdotally to say that, you know, many times when students have accelerated through school, they also tend to do very well on the SAT at an earlier
exactly.
at an earlier age. I think that, you know, if that were something that we wanted to, you know, if we're going to use that, for example, or the ACT as a proficiency exam, say, you know, once you've reached a certain level, a student could then go ahead and be graduated. I certainly would consider something like that, although that's not what the present bill contemplates.
Right. I just wonder if you'd seen anything from any other states.
Not
this time.
not at this time,
thank
right.
You.
Thank you.
Any further questions for Representative Crummell? Representative Lim.
And I'm sorry that I'm a little bit slow guy, but could you give us one more time what's the difference is Dash 3 and Dash 4?
Mr. Chair and Representative Lim, absolutely. The Dash 4 has in it that a school district can't change the requirements once a student has started the ninth grade. They would have to delay implementation for the current ninth grade class to be able to graduate before new requirements would be implemented, unless it was required by federal or state law.
Okay.
That's the one thing. So in the Dash 3, that's in there. In the Dash 4, it's out. And actually, that is the primary difference between the Dash 3 and the Dash 4. I prefer the Dash 3, but Dash 4s are fine.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Representative. Representative Dahl?
I move the Dash 4 amendment to House Bill 2606.
Representative Dahl has moved the Dash 4 amendment to House Bill 2606. Discussion? Representative Roblin.
I appreciate what Jerry has done to try to move this bill and to do the kinds of things that he's done, because some of those were concerns that I have. But I have to say, one of the things that happened when Bell Measure 550 and 47 came into being was that the state started paying most of the expenses of schools. And one of the things that the school board said is, well, we've just lost any chance to have local control. And this is one more erosion of that local control. And I have a hard time, Representative Dahl and I have had conversations about this all the time. I'm not saying what every district does is right, because I think they aren't. Jerry and I had a conversation about this, and his kid would have loved to have been at our school, because we are really clear about these kinds of things with our kids consistently. And I think local people have to make those decisions at their local board level. And if they're upset, they need to go to those school board members and say, what are you doing this for? And have real discussions about it in their local community as to why and what they're trying to do. I would hope that there's no schools that are out there forcing this to happen because they want to keep the kids there so they can keep getting the money. That would be as wrong as anything, again. And if there's any district out there that's doing that, I, for one, would start voting these kind of things and saying, I guess the state needs to start running it. But until I see that happening, it's hard for me to continue to erode what little controls they have. You know, those of us out there think we don't have much control over the curriculum we have because the state board selects it, and there's only one school district that doesn't have to choose those because of the way the statute's written. And you can go through waiver procedures and all sorts of other things, and we still have an option of doing that. This bill comes a lot closer because it does say that your state, your local requirements can be part of that requirement for graduation. When I was at principal, we tried to say, if a student transferred into us, we went and looked at their requirements under their school and ours, and if it was they were on track at the other school, we need to make them on track at our school. Or we'd actually work it out with the other sending district. We'd give them the credits, and they could go get their diploma, which is where many of them wanted to, from their other school district. And we just get them a transcript and send it. I mean, there's ways for districts to work these things out. And I would hope that there's no group out there that's sitting around thinking that they want to keep these kids who should be advancing in school, because I really don't think there are. They might make it harder sometimes, and I wish they wouldn't do that too much. But for me, it's still one more of those erosions, and I will be voting no, even though I do appreciate what Jerry has done in this last amendments. It really has made it easier for me to consider.
It was for you.
I know.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Dolan.
Yes, just a quick comment. I struggled with the same thing that Representative Roblin did when we passed the diploma issue mandating that schools give a special diploma. But I don't think that we're taking away local control as much as we are arming students. When a student is denied a diploma that they are capable of winning, or when a student wants to accelerate, what we've done is put some power in the hands of parents and students. School boards still have control over the curriculum. School boards still have control. So if we can do diplomas, I feel very comfortable in doing this.
Thank you, Representative. Further discussion? I'm supportive of the amendment. I appreciate Representative Cremel pushing forward on it. If this is not a major message to send, but it's a small message to send, that if students are excelling, then we want to encourage them to excel and to move forward and to advance as fast as they and their families believe they should. So we're still on the amendment. Is there any objection to the dashboard amendments? Hearing none. So amended. Representative Dolan.
I move House Bill 2606 to the House floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Dolan has moved House Bill 2606 to the House floor with a due pass as amended recommendation. Discussion? Representative Lim.
And I would support the dash 4, but personally, I prefer the dash 3, but it's too late. Anyway, I just want to mention that in the public record.
Thank you, Representative. Any further discussion on the bill?
Since we're not getting Representative Roblin in, can we go back and put the dash 3s in?
Get them both off.
Good try, you Representative. Without any further discussion, would you please call the roll, Andy?
Yes.
Aye.
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 No.
Aye.
Aye. So moved. Representative Cremel, would you like to carry the bill?
I'd love to, Mr. Chair.
And we will all make up our list of questions to ask you.
Yes, please do, and don't worry about letting me know ahead of time.
Could I enlist the help of Representative Roblin? We're going to drill him.
We'll work on it.
Oh, thanks.
I'll close the work session on House Bill 2606, open up a work session on House Bill 2584. Mr. Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2584, the original bill would have created a task force on morale in kindergarten through grade 12 education. What you have before you is an amendment that would replace the entire text. It's a slightly different version of what we looked at April 23rd. The only real difference is it slightly tweaked the makeup of the task force, but essentially this is the same thing as the bill we looked at on the 23rd, which is would create a 9-member task force on civics and financial education with the superintendent of public instruction, the speaker of the House, and the president of the Senate, each appointing 4 members from groups representing, I'm sorry, 3 members, my error, from groups representing school administrators, civics teachers, finance teachers, teachers who are members of labor union, school district boards, students, business leaders, and other groups with expertise in civics and financial education. We direct the task force to study and make recommendations on how to increase and improve civics and financial education in K-12 public schools. Direct the task force to submit a report to the interim committees on education by October 1st of 2008. Direct the Department of Education to provide staff support to the task force and sunset the task force in the opening of the next regular biennial legislative session. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. I would entertain a motion on the Dash 4.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2584.
Representative Dahlin has moved the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2584. Discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenlick.
I can't help but support this bill in its form since I've heard from every single I've heard from every single credit union in my district about it. But I really do mourn the loss of an effort to highlight the question of morale in schools. Because I think maybe one of the major issues we're facing in education today isn't funding. The major issue is the morale of our teachers, of our teachers' force. And I hope we can find some way to do whatever we need to do to continue to focus on the question of morale of teachers and students and other employees. I'd be happy to support this one, but I miss the other one.
Thank you, Representative. My emails do not run in the same direction as your comments on this.
You did your email.
I received a lot of emails were very upset that the topic was even brought up. I found the topic of morale.
Kind of like the dog bell.
Kind of this similar.
Yeah, but the dog bell deserves it. Quite my jury soil.
Representative Kahn.
I will be supporting this bill unequivocally because there has been only one bill in this entire session that I've gotten more email about than this one, and it wasn't even from the credit unions. So this bill has my full support.
Very good. Appreciate it.
You can get the floor and stuff.
Not yet.
You're on the amendment, yes. Is there any further discussion on the amendment? Any objections? So amended. Representative Dahlum.
I move House Bill 2584 to the House floor with a due pass as amended recommendation because I was formerly a civics teacher.
Representative Dahlum has moved House Bill 2584 to the floor with a due pass as recommended recommendation because he was formerly a civics teacher. Any discussion? Representative Clem.
Mr. Chair, I just think it's a great bill. I actually was pretty surprised when I started touring the schools when I decided I was going to run. I didn't realize personal finance was out of the classrooms.
Right.
And they were telling me that that's no longer, you know, part of what goes on. And I was really surprised. And then I'm going to, if the task force exists, I'm going to go over there and ask them to not just civics, but Oregon history as well. Because I had another bill about Oregon history. Didn't really make it anywhere. So I'm going to go and pitch the task force on Oregon history.
Very good.
So for the record.
It's taught at 8th grade.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Representative. Representative Roblin.
Yeah, I want to, same kind of comment as Representative Clem. I think this is a great bill. I had a bill that I introduced for a constituent down in the Florence area who has taught this his whole life. He's retired now, but he would like to have a center where they actually bring all this financial stuff together and help teachers learn how to teach this stuff when it's a hands-on kind of approach, which some people do well, some people don't. But there are great models out there. It would be great to have some of that kind of stuff. So I part of it is teaching kids at the right age, at those ages, you've got to have the right model to teach them. This can be one of those things that can be difficult for them to want to be at unless you really have an enjoyable time of figuring out these kinds of things and learning it in such a way that when you really do need to, you'll remember to go back and look at what I learned a while back. Because so often, they don't seem to think that they have a need for it at the moment they're doing it because they don't have a whole lot of money to deal with. They don't care about what kinds of insurance companies there are and why one's different from another. And then when they get there, they think, I think someone told me about that, but I can't remember why. I'm just figuring out ways to get it in so that it is relevant is really important. So I think it's a good bill. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative. Further discussion? Representative Greenlee, did you have something?
Yeah, did DOE not have any fiscal comments on this one?
Representative Greenlee, we worked with the proponents to bring down the number of the members of the task force from 12 to 9. Really was the reason behind the dash 4, to try to make sure we get it under the estimated 50,000.
We don't, Mr. Chair, Representative, we don't yet have any formal fiscal from legislative fiscal since they're rather swamped with bills, but I think it was hovering around the 50,000 like a lot of the task forces do, give or take, depending on.
66 was the number of that.
Yeah. I think it might be slightly over, you know, 57,000 was one possible, but again, that's draft and it hasn't gone through the final LFO.
So the speaker might yet refer this to the speaker's desk to somewhere else.
That is possible.
Thank you. This is a good deal. I like to support it, but my simple way of growing up is that the civic is the three things I like to show: love your family, love your country, love your neighbors. I think that's the good things that we teach. And as far as the finance is concerned, don't spend more than what you bring it in. That's the policy. As long as we keep that, we will be fine.
It could be a very short civics and financial lesson, Representative. Thank you so much.
Make more money than you need.
Any additional discussion? I appreciate the time spent on this, and I do look forward to supporting it, and I do hope the task force, we struggle between the idea of the mandates for schools, and tested it all to ever put a mandate on our districts because we're asking them so much already. So I'm hoping for some creative ideas of how to get this information to the students that isn't a mandate on our schools. Mr. Olson would like to make a comment before we vote.
Just one clarifying comment, just a brief discussion with the Department of Education, and the quote I gave you before about approximately 57,000, that was in the dash threes, and we're at 12 members. When you bring it down to nine, it's more like in closer to 50,000. So, as you said, it will reduce the cost, although it's not final. That's the latest estimate. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Any further discussion?
I would just note, Mr. Chair, that this looks an awful. We're on the dash one amendments.
We're on the dash four
amendments.
Dash four.
We already meant to say dash four. Looks real familiar to House Bill 3140, but as opposed to creating a task force, I don't think this is something we necessarily need to study. We just need to do it. And I would hope that instead of us spending a lot of resources on studying whether or not we should be studying civics and financial information in schools, we already know that this is an area that students need help in and need remediation in, and particularly in civics. I mean, there's a lot of people that graduate from high school that, you know, have a hard time understanding and reading the voter's pamphlet. And that's a key piece of information that an educated and well-informed voter should have and be able to understand. And the other thing that we have a lot of problems with are kids that graduate from high school and don't understand how to balance a checkbook and what it means by debits and credits and that sort of thing. So we know that the education is needed. I just hope to see our schools do it.
Well, hopefully the task force is going to, not the why should we do it, but how we can do it without it.
Get it done.
We are, just to clarify, we've already adapted the dash four when you're out.
Oh, okay.
So we are on the motion on the bill.
So Mr. Chair, as a social studies teacher, I was going to say old, but I'm not that old. As a social studies teacher, I would say, you know, this is extremely important. But I wish that we were just doing it and not doing the task force, but I'll support it.
Very good. Thank you, Representative. Any further discussion?
Who's the sponsor of the bill?
Representative Bonamici came forward. We had many different folks who were. There was a proposal for it just on civics. There's one on financial. We combined the two. There's many. Many
thank you, Mr. Chair, that Representative Wisnett on a bill.
I think Representative Wisnett actually is the driving force behind all the
half the credit.
Yes.
Skip out of that question.
Well, I think Chair Buckley gave a bill so that we could combine.
I did. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Andy, would you please call the roll?
Representative Clem?
Yes.
Representative Zalman?
Yes.
Representative
Greenway? Yes.
Representative
Paul?
Aye.
Yes, she has a civics.
Aye.
Yes, she did.
Financial.
Aye.
Aye. The motion carries. Representative Wisnett, would you be kind enough to carry this on the floor for us?
Yes, sir.
Appreciate it. Going to close the work session on House Bill 2584 and open a work session on House Bill 3141. Mr. Olson, when you're ready to roll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 31, the original bill, required students to complete a minimum number of credits to advance to grade 10, 11, or 12. That was the original bill, which I won't go into detail because we have a dash one amendment, which we discussed in committee on April 25th, which would replace the entire text and would direct the Department of Education to establish a program to increase the number of speech-language pathologists and speech-language pathology assistants in Oregon, direct the department to award grants to students studying to become licensed speech-language pathologist or speech-language pathology assistants, provide stipends to licensed speech-language pathologists who are employed by the education service districts or school districts, provide training to participants, establish eligibility requirements to qualify for grants, including agreeing to be employed in Oregon for a minimum 2 years as a pathologist or an assistant within 3 years after graduation in order to repay the grant. Establish grant levels, and it goes into set them, and you have them before you, as well as setting the stipend levels. It establishes a speech-language pathologist training fund and would appropriate $496,680 to the department for the fund, declares an emergency, and takes effect July 1st. Although the bill doesn't currently have a subsequent recommendation, the suggestion would be that it have one to Ways and Means given the suggested appropriation.
I think that's entirely appropriate. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I would take a motion on the amendment before discussion.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 3141.
Representative Dahlem has moved the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3141. Discussion. Representative Kopp.
The only comment I'd make, Chair Buckley, and thank you, is that this comes to us because of literally a crisis in the lack of speech pathologists in the state, and the fact that also the community colleges and the associations with the speech pathologists have assured me, and I hope that they've talked to other committee members, that they're willing to lobby this and share the information with the Ways and Means Committee, and if they need to make adjustments, they'd be willing to discuss those opportunities. And with that, I would endorse, you know, giving them a chance to see what they can do in Ways and Means.
Thank you, Representative.
This is on the amendment, correct?
It's on the amendment.
Mr. Chair, I just wondered, what schools do we know of, and maybe somebody on the committee knows, but what schools do we have in Oregon and the Northwest right now that are training students in speech pathology and speech pathology assistant?
You did receive testimony.
Mr. Chair, I know that specifically they were discussing Chemeketa Community College as one of the...
For the assistants.
Right.
For the assistants.
Active in this.
And then doesn't U of O have a program? I believe we heard that in testimony.
Western used to, but they don't anymore.
Right.
And so then that brings up a question, and that is, so for example, a $9,000 grant, how much would that be helping a student? I mean, is that going to be enough to pay for school or part of their living expenses or?
Mr. Chair, just the grant levels are up to $2,000 an academic year for speech language pathology assistants and $9,000 for a pathologist, and the grant is limited to the tuition costs. So if the tuition costs are less than $9,000, then the grant would be less than $9,000.
Okay.
Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Olson.
No,
finish the elaboration.
Okay, thank you.
Any other discussion on the Dash 1 amendment?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill.
I think we have to vote on the amendment first, though.
Sure.
For the discussion on the amendment, any objection to the amendment? So amended. Representative Dolan.
I move House Bill 3141 to the House floor with a due pass as amended recommendation and a subsequent referral to the Joint Ways and Means Committee.
Representative Dolan, this moves House Bill 3141 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation with a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Discussion? Representative Roblin.
You know, I hope that as a legislature we will look more favorably on these kinds of bills that incentivize things as opposed to disincentivizing things. This is one of those areas where incentivizing can be very helpful. I think there may come a point when we have enough and we'll take this bill out and start looking at something else, whether that be advanced sciences or whatever. But the idea of saying, as a state, we need these kinds of things available, and when we don't have them, we're going to start helping, I think is an appropriate way of getting that thing to happen. So, and right now, we need speech pathologists. It's a
One of the most important ways to incentivize them is to pay them more.
Yes. I would agree with that.
They're all sucked off into the
executive. Representative Greenwick and I would like to pass this bill 10 times so we could avoid Ways and Means.
Further discussion? Representative Cobb.
Thank you, Chair Buckley. And in comment to what Representative Roblin is sharing, I couldn't agree more. And the fact that the best thing that I like about this bill is that it requires the person to stay in Oregon, like some of the other bills that we've talked about today. And whether you're going to consider this good or bad, I started my collegiate career at the age of 36, and if I didn't have several different grants that were just like this, the Pell Grant and the Carl Perkins Grant, so long as I stayed in our state and helped the disadvantaged, my grants were, you know, washed away. And it was a big part why I went to work for Woodbridge School District. And so whether this is good or bad, that's up for you to say, but because it led to my journey here. But if we didn't have this type of incentive, and this was 15, 20 years ago, there are many of us that couldn't have made it through college. So,
thank you, Representative. I think the full committee is very supportive of the financial aid you were given for your education. Any additional discussion?
We don't have to vote on that.
We don't have to
no.
vote on that.
Okay.
Not mine so much.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, Andy, would you please call the roll?
Just have an amendment.
Aye.
Representative
Dolan.
Aye.
1-1.
Aye.
Representative
Hawk.
Aye.
Aye.
Representative
Lynn.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. The motion carries. Good luck in Ways and Means. House Bill 3141. I do hope the proponents do make the case for it down there. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3141 and open the work session on House Bill 2790. Mr. Olson, when you can.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2790 directs the Oregon 529 College Savings Board to award a grant to a parent of each child born in Oregon. Requires parents to use grants to open the Oregon 529 College Savings Account, appropriates monies from the general fund to the board for grants. That's the original bill. There's a -3 amendment before you, which replaces the entire text and would do the following. Defines an eligible child, an Oregon resident, and a qualified parent or guardian. It would create the Oregon 529 College Savings Incentive Program to be administered by the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. And upon application by a qualified parent or guardian, require the Student Assistance Commission to transfer a $200 incentive grant to the Oregon 529 College Savings Network individual account for an eligible child if OSAC, the Student Assistance Commission, determines that the qualified parent or guardian has established this account on behalf of an eligible child within 12 months of the child's birth or adoption. Applies to eligible children born or adopted after January 1st, 2008. Appropriates an undetermined amount to OSAC for carrying out provisions of the fund. It has a blank line currently. And declares an emergency and takes effect on July 1st, 2007. Due to the financial implications, this bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Members, I'd accept a motion on the amendments prior to our discussion.
Mr. Chair, I move the -3 amendment to House Bill 2790.
Representative Dolan moves the -3 amendment to House Bill 2790. Discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Crummell.
So if I've got the amendment correct here, or the parent or guardian has to act first instead of the College 529 plan acting first. Correct?
That's correct. Would you have to come up and join us? I mean, you're more than welcome to join in the discussion here, and since you are.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Gary Andine. I'm Executive Director of the Oregon Independent College Association. If I may indulge the Chair and ask that the other two principal players in this -3 amendment to join me, Dennis Johnson, the Director of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, and Michael Parker, the Director of the 529 State Savings Plan.
That's very hospitable of you. I'm
thank you
glad
very much,
to have
Mr.
you
Chair.
Have them join you.
Let me start by just thanking the Chair and the Committee Administrator for allowing us time last week to finish the gestation of this bill, if you will. We had hoped that it could come on Representative Butler's birthday last Wednesday, but we got postponed. So now we have another birth opportunity. I believe this is going to be the last bill that this committee births officially this session, and I'm sort of excited about that. What happened was that we thought this would be a very simple thing of simply asking the 529's college savings plan to give every student who was born in the first 12, every child born during the first 12 months a $200 starter kit. That was the original intent. It sort of morphed into that really wasn't what Oppenheimer likes to do with their time. It became necessary that we involve a state agency in distributing state funds, and so the Student Assistance Commission, that wonderful little agency in our state that can do just about anything at the drop of a dime, the little agency that could step forward and said they would be happy to help administer this program for a very nominal administrative fee. So that's the way it works now. So if a child is, if a parent or guardian opens an account within 12 months of the child's birth, then then they turn around and apply to the Scholarship Commission for this incentive grant, they will get the $200 to add to the child's account. The whole intent here is to encourage people to start their 529 plans very early, to get it going right away. If you do that, the compound interest can be quite significant, particularly if you continue to make investments in that. We think that 18 years from now, there'll be an awful lot of Oregon parents and students who will be thanking this committee for having started that kind of a plan, because it's going to make a huge difference in the amount of private funds that are available at that time. I also want to just comment that I think this is part of a shared responsibility agenda that this whole session has been on. I think there are three parts to it. The first part is the shared responsibility agenda for students now in school, and you're going to be putting a whole lot more money into the Oregon Opportunity Grant to help low- and middle-income students, and I think that's a very important piece of shared responsibility. The second important piece is for the students of next year and the year after that. With the Aspire program, which you've already approved, to help those students find their way to college and finance their college. And the third piece is looking down the road to students far into the future with a 529 savings kit that will help them raise the private capital with your public leveraging of public dollars. So it makes a really nice package of today, tomorrow, and in the future, working with families and students to put together private funds to help them with their college education. Thank you for the time.
Representative Greenlick.
How are the parents going to know about this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, both OSAC and the 529 Savings Board have promised to do serious advertising to get the word out across the whole state.
I don't know what that means.
Mr. Chair, if I might. Michael Parker, Executive Director of the Oregon 529 College Savings Network. The network has agreed to spend some advertising dollars to put this out across the state. We do obviously advertising for our plan every year, and we could add something like this to our advertising to make sure parents at least it's out there and available to them. The dollar amount is undetermined at this point, what we'd actually put forth to actually put this out to parents and other citizens.
Mr. Chair, I can follow.
Follow.
I mean, it doesn't seem to me that general advertising is going to get at those, 20,000 parents or so, or 50,000 parents a year. I mean, it seems to me if you want to get to them, you need to find some other technique. You need to get a birth certificate application in the hospitals. I mean, there needs to be ways to get to them that are very different, because it's a very short time frame. And if they heard about it 5 years before,
and we'll be there here for about 2 months after they need to, is not going to help. It's, you need to get to them somewhere.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, we have been in discussions with other people who are putting a lot of literature in the hands of newborn mothers, if you will. There are some standard pieces of literature that go into the hands of those people as they leave the hospital, and we would hope that this would be part of that literature.
Mr. Chair, I wanted to address Representative Kremel's comment about, you know, who's actually responsible for this, and I just want to make clear that the 529 program is simply the vehicle here. Our program manager, Oppenheimer, we're under a specific contract with them, and public policy-wise, we don't think it's a good idea for them just to receive state dollars without a state agency or someone else from the state overlooking where that money is going. So that's when we actually employed the help of Dennis and OSAC to say, okay, some state agency should be looking at this, where this money goes, and then actually approve the dollars that are going, qualify these kids who are being born here, rather than just having Oppenheimer get a check from the state because they said someone applies to the plan. So there is a public policy question here about who's checking the dollars, where they're going, and how they're being spent. Oppenheimer is simply the vehicle. We're simply the vehicle in this. As you may or may know, we have a priority bill that actually raises our deduction for the college savings plan this session as well. So that's our priority bill. And we're simply the vehicle that allows this program to go forward. Dennis and his group are the ones that are actually doing the check and verifying the records that are coming in from parents.
Additional questions? Representative Trump.
The only other comment that I would like to make, and I was thinking much like a Representative Greenlee, that as a mother of a newborn, you are given a number of pieces of literature. There's only one really good way to make sure parents recognize this, and if you get those little stickers, any kind of sticker like Representative Crummel has on, and you stick it on that infant carrier before they leave.
that might do it.
Representative Robert. Those nurses, when they check you out, they make sure you got all that stuff. And so if you had, make sure you had your sticker. So.
Representative Robert.
Yes, thank you. Just a 529 question. If they don't use it to go to school, what happens with the fund in the 529?
Chair Buckley, Representative Roblin, it's my understanding that this bill, the way it's structured, is once the money is transferred to the parent or the student, the state has given up rights to the money. So if someone opens up an account for $250, which is our minimum, and they apply with OSAC for the $200 grant, they meet all the requirements, the state would send them $200. Under the current bill as it stands, the next day, that parent can close that account and take the $200. There is no policy in this bill that requires them to use it for education. If they keep the money in there for a while and they decide to withdraw it without using it for school, there's a 10% penalty on the earnings, but there's no policy the money comes back to the state. You effectively have given it up to that parent under the current policy of this bill.
Representative Roblin.
One other little quick question. That is, if we've had 529 for a little while now, but it's not been around for a long time. Have there been anybody who just hasn't, they forgot they even have it? I was wondering if there's this non-collectible and whatever happens with all of that at some point.
Mr. Chair, Representative Roblin, we've had 529 now in the state since 2001. We're currently almost at $900 million in assets since that time, so we're actually doing quite well. To answer your question, yes, there's always folks who put in $25 and then forget it's there. We do periodic pings to folks who just tell me your account has been inactive for so long. Do you want to keep it or do you want to close it? The money, though, is their money. So, for example, if I have $200 in my account and I just forgot about it, it's still my money. It doesn't go to like unclaimed property or anything like that. It's still my money. Our program manager will touch you and say, you know, you haven't had any activity for a year. Would you consider closing it? Do you want to keep it open? And if we don't hear back from them, the account stays open because we have really no ability to close their account. But we also want, if they don't want to use it, we want to take it off of our books and return the money to them. But it is the person's money. It is not connected to the state whatsoever.
One final question.
Representative Roblin.
It's one final 529 question. Right now there's a limit on how much grandparents or parents can put into a 529 per year annually and get the tax deduction. What is that, and shouldn't we be increasing it?
Okay, Grandpa.
I love this question.
Yes, I had mentioned our priority bill, the Power Savings Funds Priority Bill, which is House Bill 2462, which raises the tax deduction from the current $2,000 per return per year. It's per return, not per person. It's per return. So married couples $2,000 and single filers $2,000, to changing that to $4,000 per person or $8,000 per couple. Okay. Our research shows, and it's almost a direct correlation, that the amount of the deduction is what folks are going to put into these plans. So really our policy is let's leverage those personal dollars. Let's use the tax deduction to leverage personal dollars, getting more kids into college. That's our board's goal, is to get more kids access to college. A deduction would make that happen at a much larger degree. So we are looking for that bill to hopefully get some legs in House revenue. We had a hearing last week to raise that up to $8,000.
One final comment. Just having been a Gear Up school and worked in Gear Up and recognizing the power of letting people know that if they invest in themselves educationally, they can go on to college and they can change their lives. And seeing how that works with a number of kids and the history of those kinds of programs throughout the country from philanthropists that have let it happen. This is the kind of program that gets kids, parents talking about their kids going to college from birth. And hopefully they'll keep watching it, realizing it's growing and saying, you know, we're helping you get there. So I think it's a great idea, even though I think there are some issues about it that make you a little nervous and you don't want people to do, but I still think it's a good idea. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions. First, I'd like to follow up on Representative Roblin. Most people would leave the money in the account, though, wouldn't they? I mean, the chances of a person opening an account with $250, getting the $200 from the state, and then closing the account and taking the, well, at that point it would be $450, and walking away with it are pretty slim, aren't they?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, probably yes. The reason we're asking them to open the account, we want them to take that step to start the plan, rather than just giving the $200 when they're born. So they have to take a step to do that. So I would have to say yes. Most folks probably open the account, put the $250 in, and then get their grant. And hopefully the goal of the bill is really to have them keep saving. To have $450 in there for 18 years does them absolutely really no good at the end of the day. You want them to keep putting money in it over that period of time. So I would have to say, yeah, they probably would leave the money in there and hopefully can keep contributing to it.
However, Mr. Chair, if I may, even if they didn't add another dime to it, it would continue to grow at whatever the rate is growing at, and so it might only be a couple $1,000 at the end of 18 years, but it'd be a couple thousand more than they would have, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, that is correct. It would keep continuing to grow at whatever investment option they put it in, depending on their risk tolerance. But just a policy question. The 529 program was established for, I think, certain investors, middle-income investors. Some folks probably shouldn't take advantage of 529 based on their certain circumstances. So I would say that very, very low-income folks may not get the benefit out of this that someone that's making, you know, middle-income dollars, two-time middle-income dollars make. So there is a risk. It's a market-based plan. You just talked about a financial education bill just previous to this. Really, financial education is the key, almost the key to this, because put the money in, but then know what you're doing, know how to invest it, know how to manage it. That's very, very important. So that kind of gets to your point about great to put it in there, but understand that it's an investment, it's market-based, it's market risk, and it's not necessarily going to do you much good unless you understand how to manage it and keep contributing to it.
Right. Mr. Chair, another question, if
Paul,
I may?
Yes.
In Section 4, it's talking about the amount of money that would come out of the general fund for the purpose of carrying out the provisions. And then also in Section 3, Sub 7, it talks about to publicize. One of the primary responsibilities now is going to be to publicize the plan. So wrapping two questions into one, how much is it going to cost for you to carry out these provisions? And is it something that is going that you could do within existing resources?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, I will speak to Section 3, Sub 7, which directs the College Savings Network to publicize the program. The legislature appropriates money to the College Savings Program every 2 years, just like everybody else, and we would incorporate the publicization of this program within our current marketing budget. That does not speak to, though, the actual impact that I think Dennis can speak to.
Mr.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cromwell, you should receive shortly a fiscal impact statement that we prepared.
Can you identify yourself?
I'm sorry, Dennis Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
With the Student Assistance Commission. And I'm hoping you have that. Has it been distributed?
It will be in just a minute. We're just
okay.
Preparing.
What you'll see is our best guess, starting with the premise of perhaps 48,000 births each year, perhaps a third of those being activated when the program gets underway or accounts for a third of those young children. And then what is the record keeping? What does it cost to make sure that we're matching up the names, dates of birth, social security numbers, the accounts that have been set up in the treasurer's office, the 529 accounts? Basically, it's a verification, a fiduciary kind of responsibility here. We're estimating about a fourth of an FTE when this program gets running. It's going to take some time, some startup IT expense, but once this is rolling, it's not a great burden. So very minimal expense, but some very necessary checking and just verification on an ongoing basis.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
So, Mr. Chair, am I reading this right, that the fiscal impact would be about $25,759?
I don't believe so, Representative. Yeah. It looks like the general fund appropriation they're projecting is $4.5 million, if I'm reading that correctly, Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. The impact on our agency is about the $25,000 range in the first year.
Mr. Chair, Representative, for clarification, we don't have anything official yet from Legislative Fiscal. This is the draft. It's the and so the it's based on an estimate of how many people would pick up the account, which is where you get the millions figure. But you're correct on the amount for OSAC is itself is relatively small.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Cromwell, clearly, I think as far as the amount that gets paid out every biennium is directly tied to how well we get the word out. The more folks that hear about it, they're going to take advantage of it. If you don't get the word out, folks aren't going to know about it. So that there's a direct correlation there.
Exactly.
Thank you. So the $4.5 million figure is however many people times $200.
Yeah.
Okay, gotcha. I'll go to my question on the other topic just for a second. I mean, you know, for Dennis's sake, that's pretty modest. I mean, this is coming in at a very reasonable amount. That agency, mostly after my efforts there, is fairly lean. And I worry a little bit that's not enough, but, you know, we have to see, I guess. May I ask my other question?
Please.
On the Oppenheimer or whoever has the contract in the future, they invested in a variety of different options. Do you have to pick within, or is it sort of a limited number of choices, or where is it usually invested in?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clem, when you sign up, you pick the option you want to be in. So when someone signs up, again, we're just the vehicle here, so someone needs to sign up for the program like anybody would, even if you didn't take advantage of this program. Right. You sign up, you pick your option based on your risk tolerance, and then you would then apply to the Assistance Commission for the $200 grant. At that point, because you would have sent in materials to the commission allowing us to put money in your account, then the commission would just simply wire the money in and send it into Oppenheimer, and they'd invest it. So Oppenheimer is only just receiving the contribution. They're not connected to this program other than the fact they're just investing the dollars.
Follow-up. A piece of information that I would be curious about. Does Oppenheimer generally invest in the broader market, or do you know?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clem, we invest basically in the domestic stock market and some international stocks. So, it depends on where you want your money. You want it in bonds, you want it in stocks. We'll give you the option to put where you want to put it. That's correct. And it's mostly domestic stocks.
Mm-hmm. Is it Ribbon?
Yeah, real quickly, just to follow up on that. Oppenheimer, the funds go out. You put your $250 in, and you pick your risk level. And they take a portion of the interest that's made on it, or do they? How do they make their
money?
Yeah,
Mr. Chair, Representative Roblin, the The Oregon College Savings Plan is a very inexpensive option within 529. How it is done is that Oppenheimer takes a fee from the money invested, and the state takes a small fee to administer the program. So just to give you an example, if you were putting your money into basically an all-equity option, you're going to pay about 0.8% annually on your money, which in the world of 529 is very, very inexpensive. Just as an aside, our board has worked very hard to get fees down because, as you know, fees eat up return, and so we're going to continue to lower those fees as much as we possibly can. And so when Oppenheimer was hired, we said, look, we'll hire you, but you're going to lower the fees, and they responded to do that.
Thank you, Representative Lim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The proposal request of the money from the general funds, it is $45 million.
4.5.
Yeah, $4.5 million. And the following biennium is $6 million. Okay, what happened if someone expected more than, you know, parents asking for, then this money might run out? Then what happened if you don't have money?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, my feeling is that we would deal with this in rules, and we would establish a waiting list for parents who would be funded in a future biennium. It would be a wonderful problem to have, in a sense, but difficult for those parents who might have to wait a few months until we could start their accounts. If we establish rules that allow us to have a waiting list, then prioritize those people as soon as more funding becomes available, I think that would be about as fair as we could be if the funds are insufficient.
A follow-up question.
Follow-up.
So that they have authority to make such rules.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, yes. The statute, as it is written, allows us to establish those rules. The commission would establish them, and we would implement them in a very transparent way.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Jim, I want to ask some questions, and Representative Clem, I'd appreciate any input you'd have on this as well. I'm starting to, as I listen to this, I have concerns, one being that it's actually possible to lose money with this account, whether that's a too realistic of a concern or not. I'd love to feedback on that. The second, we don't have this being need-based at all, so I guess the real hard question I'd have to ask is, given the financial situation the state has, gut instinct, are we better off with money in our needs-based student responsibility model, or are we better to do this type of widespread distribution? I really back the idea of trying to reach every family. I'm just questioning whether this is the vehicle to do so. I'd appreciate any feedback from the panel, Representative Clem.
I'll chime in. I think, as Gary actually talked about earlier, it's sort of a three-pronged approach. You know, the Aspire program isn't needs-based, so there we say, you know, if you want to go to college, we're going to counsel you on how to do it. The Opportunity Grant, which is our major investment vehicle, is clearly needs-based. You know, and that's going to be, after this biennium, you know, $117 million of strictly needs-based. So to have, you know, $4 to $5 or $6 million to say to people who end up just on the other side of even the shared responsibility line and above, that we think, and you know, it's people pay a lot of taxes as well, by the way, we think that your kids are also worth, you know, a $200 investment just like every low-income kid. I think it's, if you look at it all collectively, all three of those together, then I think it's reasonable. If we didn't have the major infusion in the needs-based aid program over the last biennium and then again this biennium, I'd probably feel differently. But, I mean, this is, you know, 4% of what we're doing by the time this thing's over on the shared responsibility model.
Any feedback, gentlemen?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Gary Ann Dean again. The original vision was that this would be $200 to every baby, period, rich and poor alike. Right. Now it's going to require you actually taking some effort on your own to sign up and start the plan. The likelihood of gaming it for $200, I think, is pretty slim. The chances are by the time you've had the baby and waited a number of months to get the Social Security number so you could apply for the plan itself, and then waited some more months while OSAC verified that you were indeed qualified, That's a long time to have to wait to try to steal $200 from the state. I don't think there's going to be a lot of that. I may be idealistic, but I envision a situation where a lot of people who do not have a lot of resources but see the opportunity to start this will get the message from this building that every kid born in Oregon, we think, is college-bound material. And in some cases, some churches will step up and say, let's help that family launch that new baby along with the baptism. Why doesn't the church put in $250 to get this plan, this plan going? I can see a lot of possible ways that you might help this be extended to more than the usual group of people who sign up for savings plans. It's going to take some kind of advertising and some kind of creativity for that to happen, but I hope you give us a chance.
Mr. Chair, again, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Parker again. A couple of just things come to mind. I'll just reiterate that again, the folks that are signing up, the plan is in the market, so there is investment risk. And I just want to, I'm not a registered investment advisor, but people need to know that when they put the money in, that there is an investment risk, and you could lose dollars. The second point I want to make is that the 529 plan, again, back in its infancy in 2001, was started to help sort of that middle income group, the folks that really don't qualify for a lot of aid and are going to put themselves into debt, and those folks that have a lot of money can just write the check for college tuition and college funding. So this program really, it isn't necessarily for the 529 program, that isn't for very, very, very poor folks. They probably should be focusing on something else. This is for that middle income folks, working families, two parents working, that have a couple, three kids that aren't going to be able to write the check and aren't going to be able to save enough. Again, with the tax deduction help and the low fees and the good investments, get them to a place where they can maybe save two, 3 years worth of college. That's what the 529 program is initially started for. That's what states started these programs to do. So I just want to make that distinction.
Thank you very much. Representative Roblin.
My final comment on it. I think the bill we just passed a little while ago about financial and civics education and that field. This is, to me, one of those exactly perfect things for a high school student whose parents started this, who've watched it. They get this little printout every year saying what their funds have been doing, and they can actually move it around depending on the risk. For the first time, we'll have kids at high school who have a reason to understand about the market, which is theirs. I mean, they will have seen what has happened for the first 14 years of it, and they've got four more years of make wise investments before they go to college, and they actually have an investment that they're looking at that can help them. Many of those middle class kids never had, because the parents really didn't have the wherewithal to put it away when they were younger. I think it's a perfect match for the bill. So from that perspective, I think it's a good thing.
Representative Dahlem.
Just, I hope, a short comment. As a grandfather, I've started this program for each of my five grandchildren. Hope I don't get too many more. Watching the awareness that a parent would have to just sit down and look at this for a moment, I think is a good investment in the state's money. Then they may decide, yay or nay, but at least the awareness was made. So I'm going to support the bill, the amendment, and support it on the floor.
Thank you. So, Representative Klim.
I'm just going to make a comment, and then I won't make one after we get all the amendments done and things. You know, when we were hearing about this earlier, Mitch, Representative Greenlick, talked about how he had had this memory, and it triggered for me this memory, too, where even though, you know, no Clems had gone to college, and Coos Bay was not a place where it was an automatic part of the culture that you were going to go to college, but my grandmother, as a widow, somehow set up these college funds for my brother and I, and so it was always a given, even though we knew we didn't have the financial resources. It was there, and she had put it away for us. And there was never any doubt that I was going to go to college. You know, luckily, there was financial aid and work study and all that. So I did go, but it was there my whole life. I knew that over at the little Benjamin Franklin savings and loan, my grandmother had put this money away, and it was up to me to meet that. And so I think it is very powerful. And, you know, my big belief in general about higher ed is that watch the investment return on investing in Oregon's children versus even the stock market that they're going to be racing against in their own fund, and watch how much they contribute to this economy in this state, you know, once they go to college, and it'll blow away the S&P 500 or the Dow 13,000 or whatever they're at now.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Dahlem.
You ready for a motion?
I'm wondering, is there anyone else who wanted to speak on this bill? Anyone else?
I can find somebody in the... No.
Okay. We are on the dash 3. We have a motion on the dash 3. Is there any further discussion on dash 3? Any objection? So amended. Representative Dahlem.
I move House Bill 2790 to the House floor with a due pass as amended recommendation and a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Dahlem has moved House Bill 2790 to the floor with a due pass as recommended recommendation. I'm almost there. With a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Representative Roblin.
I was just hoping that the bill that was introduced along with this one, which would allow $8,000 per couple, would really allow $8,000 per investment if they have five grandkids, so you could have a $40,000 investment. But I don't think we go quite that far. It will only keep it $8,000 for you. You have to spread it up on our kids.
Representative Cromwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I got the question answered about how much. Could this be done within existing resources?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cromwell, as far as the plan goes, to advertise it, so as far as the 529 program, yes, we're going to do this within our existing budget to publicize this program. So we won't be asking for an additional limitation to, unless the legislature wants us to do a huge amount of advertising, then that's, but we are going to try to do our best to put this out as much as we can. What we can't do is sacrifice our main marketing program in favor of this, but we will actually try to include this in some things that we do.
And what about from OSAC? Can you? I mean, if Ways and Means says, you know, we like the policy, but we're not gonna give you the limitation. Could you do it with the people that you currently have? Could you do it in existing resources?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cromwell, it would be extremely difficult for us. We're a staff of about 23, 24 people right now, and we have over 350 programs that we administer. We will have some expansion with the expansion of the opportunity grant to the shared responsibility model, but that would be taking resources from one vital area and rededicating a portion of them to this. That would be extremely difficult for us. We need a little bit of extra help. Every fairly complex program that comes down the pike requires time and dedicated effort, and this one isn't particularly complicated, but it will require attention to detail. The IT expense will be a one-time kind of sunk expense, figuring out how we match this data. But these data are going to keep coming. We need somebody to monitor them and make sure that quality control is acceptable.
And Mr. Chair, President Cromwell, I guess just to be crystal clear, as far as the $4.5 million go, then the answer would be no. It cannot be done within existing resources for either agency. I think we're splitting up the $4.5 million really is coming from the general fund. We can publicize it within our existing marketing program, but the $4.5 million would have to come from the general fund.
I agree. Thank you.
Representative Lim. He was talking. Okay. I believe this is a good program, not necessarily because the money, of course, is important, but the mindset we are giving to the children. I think there's more value in it. You know, in my own way, I saved $200 for my grandson. He's 5 years old. Now it's got about $10,000 in it. When I talk to him, I always talk, you know, we are saving money for you, for the college. And so always I'm giving his mind the value and the opportunity we are giving him. I think the opportunity, the mindset, and incentive, and a mental attitude, I think are far more important than the dollar value itself.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Clem, do you have any other thoughts you want to say? Representative Dahlem, you're right. I'm ready to roll. Members, Representative Lim just articulated my point of view as well in terms of the need to break through that mindset. I'm not convinced that this is the vehicle to do it. I do have tremendous concern. I have tremendous concern about fighting for the higher ed budget that we currently have and trying to find ways to get up. The regionals, for instance, the co-chairs budget have taken that hit out of their budget lines, and my regional is in great trouble. My community college is in great trouble. I just have this tremendous concern about funding what we're setting out to do. I'm not comfortable that this is, the way it's set up, going to reach the objectives that I share with Representative Lim in terms of reaching out to every family in Oregon. I will be a no vote on this, but I do appreciate the energy and the intent behind the bill. very, very much. I'm just not sure we're there yet in terms of this being a vehicle. Andy, would you be so kind as to call the roll?
This is as amended.
This is as amended?
Yes.
Aye.
Excuse.
Aye.
Nope. The motion carries. Good luck with Ways and Means.
Yeah, your speech notwithstanding, I'm not sure that.
members, I want to thank you very much for your work getting through our agenda, not only today, but for all the House bills that we were able to consider. We got back to our subcommittees starting tomorrow, I believe, and I look forward to working the agenda of the Senate bills throughout May, and appreciate your hard work. And I need to close the work session on House Bill 2790, and with that, members, we're adjourned.